Okay, good afternoon and good morning to our listeners in the Pacific time zone. My name is Major Davis, and I am a retired officer of the United States Air Force. As an overall introduction to the Air Force Veterans Network, I want to talk to you about a very serious matter regarding the state of our nation. The events of January 6, 2021 should concern all of us. We witnessed for the first time in our lives a deadly conflict between the civilian law enforcement and the military personnel inside the U.S. Capitol building. On this day, we witnessed the death of a civilian Capitol Police officer, Mr. Brian Sicknick, and a retired Air Force Airman, Ashley Babbitt, and very few people are talking about it. Therefore, I'm starting a weekly podcast called the Blue and Green Talk Show to start a dialogue between civilian police officers and military personnel. The overall purpose of the show is to heal the wounds between these two groups and put our focus back on serving the American people. I'm launching the Air Force Veterans Network and ask that all veterans, regardless of branch of service, and active and retired law enforcement persons, join me by signing up at www.afvets, that's AFVETS.net, to get connected and informed about our show. We have to make sure that the blue and green never again fight each other. In addition to all that I have mentioned, we endeavor to broaden our knowledge of all other happenings going on in our world today. Thus, we have invited to the Blue Green podcast an individual who is very knowledgeable on several aspects of the inner workings of our government. The information that she will bring will be most appropriate, especially in recent days events, and will broaden the knowledge base of the subscribers to our www.afvets.net. Without further ado, I would like to introduce our guest, Attorney Sue Gostricklett, Trade Compliance Counsel for the CFIUS. Now, that's Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. Welcome, Attorney Strickland.
Very glad to be with you this afternoon.
You bet. If I can get just a little bit of the background that you have. I did do, like say, research on you, and I was impressed. So I want to just go ahead and share what I found out. I know that you attended undergrad at the Catholic University in Washington, D.C.
Actually, law school. I went to Catholic University Law School.
Sorry. Columbus Law School, you bet. Right. Columbus School of Law, you bet. Yeah, I know that's on that campus. I know because being at Howard University where I was, I would always look across the lake and I saw this multicolored dome. And I could not figure out that maybe that's a vision of heaven, you know, because it's very ornate in there. And I was told that it was part of the Catholic University campus. I did not know that. So
we had our law school graduation in the church. It was the most beautiful law school graduation anywhere in the country.
Oh, okay, then yeah, because I think it has to do with the Immaculate Conception. You bet. And so that's very impressive. Like, so you guys were being watched even though you didn't know it. So I'm glad we cleared that up. But also, and when I was looking at your information, I noticed certain things that I would like to just bring up, and maybe you could kind of enlighten me and enlighten the listeners as well. Like I mentioned, Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. Now, these days, as one hears the term foreign, it may just conjure up concepts such as European Union, NATO, G20, all things vis-a-vis Ukrainian, Russian, and the list goes on whenever you hear foreign. So I didn't know if through your function with the CFIUS, you get involved in any of that, if you could explain. And then as a means of further defining who you are, I took note of and would like to look at your hashtags. You had several hashtags, about five hashtags, and they're kind of intriguing because I don't know what any of them mean. So that's why we're doing this. I said, I'm going to go ahead and just approach you with those. I saw hashtag CFIUS. And again, Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. Can you enlighten us, though? What exactly happens with that?
So the Committee on Foreign Investment U.S. is a 9-member agency. The lead agency is the Department of Treasury.
Oh.
Department of Defense, Department of State, Department of Energy. There are 9 agencies that are in the committee.
Wow.
The Treasury Department has regulations that the committee enforces. It's an enforcement agency. And what it does is it reviews investments from foreign companies, foreign entities in the United States in several sectors that have national security implications, critical infrastructure, critical technology, real estate near a military establishment, and a few others, databases that are personally identifiable information of American citizens that private companies have access to and transact in it. So these are U.S. national security assets that are in the private sector that can be leveraged by our enemies. And these are leaks in our national security environment. So the CFIUS's job is to monitor, they have oversight, monitor as well as regulate foreign investments. Now, the United States is the largest recipient of foreign investments.
Okay.
Above and beyond any other country. And we Americans benefit from it. Our economy grows, our job grows, opportunity grows, it keeps us competitive, innovative, and the most powerful country in the world. It's because we allow the world, the best and brightest in the world, to invest in our country and make it better. However, with that investment comes leaks where it can be exploited. So where we find that the investor has ties to enemy sovereign states, whether it's in financing or equity stakes, where there are loopholes in export control or intellectual property thefts, we look into that and we make sure that these are instances that are limited. So we take the risk, but we minimize the risk. We can never get ever 100% eliminate the risk. So we get a lot of the good, but we try to minimize it. And in the case of CFIUS, CFIUS is able to not only determine that there is some danger there, but CFIUS is regulatorily empowered to divest of that transaction, even after it's over. So we can go back and divest from those entities where we find that there is a national security threat. So that's the role of CFIUS. I think the role of CFIUS in general, I'll tell you, has improved foreign investment in our country. So we're not Fortress America, okay? We're America that's welcoming, but we want to make sure that it's fair trade and safe trade.
Great. It's like a watchdog function there. And I picked up a new acronym, CFIUS, because I would not have ventured that because I was trying to figure out. I said, let's see if I get an acronym out of this. I better leave that alone because I don't want to embarrass you or insult you. But it's interesting now. I'm going to address in that business, to me, would be almost, well, not quite the elephant in the room, the oligarchs and from Russia. And I know they tried to spread wherever they could spread out. I don't know if they have been a blip on your radar screen, if they've been like not a nuisance or nothing, because they come across as being kind of the nice guys. But I'm aware of the soccer team in England type of thing, because they had nothing to do with us. But I know that they try to branch out and spread out. So have they been a challenge or anything in that regard with the oligarchs from Russia?
I would agree with you there that they are an extraordinary challenge, okay?
Okay.
And the reason it's challenging is because of the amount of money that's involved.
Yes.
Okay. And when you write $1 million check, you can buy a lot of friends. And that is a serious danger. Okay.
Yes.
So yes, they're a threat, but one thing I want to add for you here is the oligarchs are not just Russian. Okay.
Okay.
So the oligarchs are Chinese. They could even be Germans. So it doesn't have to be countries that we know they're threats, but it could also be countries that we consider as our friend. So oligarchs in general are a threat. And two reasons. Oligarchs almost always have government license from their home country. So they are in cahoots with the government. And that's a, so you add the money to the government power, you've got a lot of power there, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's a big problem. The second thing is that they seem to be involved in everything. So oligarchy means that they're these massive giant industrialists that control many, many industries.
Yes.
Okay. And some of those industries are actually industries that have a huge impact in our military industrial complex. Mm-hmm. So today, you know, in yesteryear, we had actual manufacturing and oil and gas and coal. Okay. That was 20th century. Today, we have the digital platform, which is almost as big and with big impact. We have rare earth minerals, you know, things like lithium, who would have thought, you know, nickel. These are things that are critical technology, critical infrastructure. So what was true in the 20th century, you can, okay, so you have also genetic and nanotechnology, biotech, that create robots out of people.
Yeah.
I think the impact is so wide and so significant. Mm-hmm. So I could tell you, prior to 2018, someone like me would be losing sleep just to assess the threat. Okay. Wow. What happened in 2018 is several different statutes were passed in cooperation with a bipartisan Congress and a really, really, in my books, a very effective president who was aware of not just the national security threat to our homeland, mm-hmm. but aware of what our military men and women need when they are representing us in faraway countries that are often in hostile environments. So our national security, it doesn't really only concern our national borders. So our president of the past, President Trump,
yes,
forced bipartisanship in 2018,
okay,
where you had John Cornyn and Senator Dianne Feinstein, two of very strange bedfellows,
The
staff worked together. The staff were phenomenal. We have congressional staff asset that if they work together, they can do wonders. So we passed several different statutes in 2018, and they were implemented in starting with 2020, mm-hmm. and it's still in the implementation stage. That's how CFIUS rules were tightened. So that enforcement mechanism, I would say, definitely we have a long way to go, such as we're looking at limiting foreign grants to universities, which are a huge threat. Mm. Okay, professors that are in the pay, and these professors are getting government money to do research where they're also getting money from the Chinese and from a lot of hostile actors, oligarchs.
Okay.
We have a ways to go, but I think we're almost, I would tell you from the perspective of current statute and implementation, we're almost 70% there. And that gives me a lot of comfort knowing that we have a lot of, a great degree supervision, oversight. Mm. We can't be everywhere at all things to all people, but we can definitely address our national security in a very single-minded way. I think we are doing a good job as far as the United States government looking out for our homeland security and our men and women overseas.
That's fantastic. Well, like I say, my true test of the measure of greatness is the fact you hadn't made the front page. You're not only, you know, always on the evening news. You're kind of like a behind the scenes actor. That is very, very important. I mean, so you guys are the all-stars when you listed the agencies involved. That's really great. And now, and then you caught me speeding a little bit. I'm guilty of profiling, which I never thought I did. I said, yeah, the Russian oligarchs. You said, oh, there's more oligarchs than just the Russians. And I'm thinking, well, of course there are. But I said, they know. I'm thinking, shame on me. I'm guilty of profiling, but you bet. Well, I appreciate that explanation, but I'm going to go on to that next hashtag, because I'd say your hashtags are really interesting. People said, hashtag, what are you focusing on those? I want to know. Is it hashtag export controls? Export controls, I think you may have touched on it, but I said trade? Surely not trade and barter. Export controls. Import? Nope. She said export controls. What's that?
So we have several different statutes from the 1970s that are that touch on arms control. Okay. So prior to the 1950s, all of our military hardware, software, whatever we did, were for our domestic consumption.
Okay.
We made things for our own protection and our own projection of power. Okay.
Yes.
But starting with the Eisenhower period in the 1950s, this was post-war, we saved the world. The silent generation of Americans saved the world.
Wow.
And when we saved the world, after that, we needed to continue to make sure that the world remained safe. You don't want to go back and fight that war again.
No.
So as a consequence of that, we engaged in treaty alliances, okay?
Mm.
And those major treaties everybody is talking about these days. So we had NATO. Everybody knows that that is covering most of Europe today.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had other treaties, such as the Australia-US treaty, Japan-US treaty. There's a Southeast Asian Seattle Pact, similar. There are multiple treaties that we have allies where we sell as well as assist in co-development of military technology. And those are also the countries where we have bases, where our men and women in the armed services serve. So those are our treaty allies. Post-1970s, what we try to figure out is, because many of our treaties were co-developed and co-manufactured, we also figured out export control, meaning we wanted to make sure that our treaty allies also enforced control over what they sold.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a second tier and a third tier control of limiting intellectual property theft as well as sale of U.S. origin technology. So if you look at defense dual use technology today, believe it or not, there are only two countries still today, regardless of what you hear about China or Germany or Britain or whichever country manufactures, or France.
Okay.
If you really look at origins of technology, there are only two countries. There is the United States and then there's Russia. And it really hasn't changed much. So China today still has mostly Russian origin technology.
Okay. In the communist bloc,
You say, aren't the Chinese our friends? Yeah, they've been for a while, but they've never abandoned Russian technology and Russian trade. That's a fact.
Right.
France manufactures quite a bit of defense, but if you really look at their defense, it's mostly U.S. origin technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's not original French.
Mm-hmm.
Germany's the same way. Britain's mostly the same way. Okay. So export control looks at mostly U.S. origin technology because that's who we're selling to. And all of those U.S. origin technology, what we've tried to do is further bind export control licensing with arms control treaties such as Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Missile Control Regime, a nuclear biological proliferation. So there are multiple proliferation or anti-proliferation licensing elements. So when we look at export control, U.S. export control, our statutes apply, but we also look at multilateral treaties that obligate the countries we're selling to. Are they treaty signatories, and can we hold them to those treaty enforcements.
Mm.
So our export control is the lead agencies for that. For defense trade control, it's housed in the State Department Munitions Control.
Mm-hmm.
That's the enforcement agency for military hardware. Then for dual use, meaning things that are both dual and commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out once I got a license from the Department of Commerce to donate medicine and soap to North Korea.
What?
Donate.
Really?
Yes. And it turns out that soap also had to go through dual use. I mean, it's just simple soap, because certain elements in soap can be proliferated for chemical weapons purposes.
Wow.
Certain elements in just a caterpillar, you know,
yeah,
digging equipment can mm-hmm. be exploited in military use.
I can see that.
So you have dual use components that are regulated by the Department of Commerce,
okay,
export control, and arms control licensing. Defense is regulated by the State Department Munitions Control. So these are areas where we have to go through license for most things that are critical technology, critical infrastructure.
Mm.
And you'll see two different hashtags there, foundational and emerging technologies. That's a new word where the Department of Commerce licenses if it's determined to be in the critical technology area. So that's export control. It's actually cleaner now, post 2018 statute. Mm. It's cleaner and more streamlined.
Okay.
Much more understandable to the companies out there that find our regulatory environment extremely confusing and difficult to navigate. But it's easier to navigate. It's easier to understand for non-lawyers. And I think the staff at the Department of Commerce has become very, very much more attentive to mm-hmm. some of the confusions and responsive to clearing it up. So it's functioning better than it's ever had, but we have a long way to go. We can do better.
You touched on one of the other hashtags, emerging technologies. And I think you talked about that as well. Because now in my mindset, I'm putting everything, I guess, in these days on Ukraine, Russia type of thing. So I'm doing that. I said emerging technologies. Well, we know about the hypersonic missile. Now, obviously, you guys probably won't even get involved with that aspect of it.
Yes.
You know, but
that's actually defense. It's not dual use, as you said.
Okay, gotcha.
Correct. And I can give you my opinion on it for what it's worth.
Please do. It's helping me clear this thing up, because this, you know, help.
I think there are a lot of social media conversations on hypersonic, okay?
Yes.
And I think a lot of that conversation has been influenced by conferences. And these conferences are not just American, okay? They're taking mm-hmm. place in the globe. And I think there is an angle, let's call it a political angle,
okay,
by China and Russia,
mm-hmm.
or I think if you can call it China and Russia, but I call it Soviet enamored conversations.
Oh, I got you. So
I think it's a bigger field than just those two countries. Soviet enamored technology and infrastructure, right?
Okay.
So these are conversations that are taking place in multiple theaters and many different countries.
Wow.
And there is a perception that somehow there is an arms race where China and Russia have a lead. Okay. So And again, if you have a perception that's going around, I tend to believe that it's helped along by the Soviet enamored folks out there, okay? That's my personal private hunch. And these conversations have taken place in the past with other types of technologies, okay? Long ago, this type of conversation took place with the stealth bomber, okay?
Oh, yeah.
That somehow this is fictitious and there is no edge here. The Soviet Union has it covered. Similar conversations have taken place on other technologies. And what has happened as we look back is that, you know, Ronald Reagan's SDI. So that's another trope out there. So what has happened in that sphere is people tend to think that science fiction can become reality. And so they look for these angles. But in my kind of technologist point of view, the only defense establishment that makes it a reality is the United States of America. There is nothing else. So we as a country explored that in the 1980s, hypersonic. It was briefly abandoned because we felt that other things could do a better job with our objectives. And then it was picked up at some point, I would say in the last 10 years, by our military establishment. And of course, you're not going to get too much on it unless we succeed and tests show that we are far ahead. You're not going to get much on it, okay? But I can tell you, because I know what the history has shown, is that whatever is out there, we've got this covered.
Okay.
We don't have an arms race. There is a competition, certainly. Obviously, everything is a competition. Competition makes us better. Okay.
Yeah, it does.
Let the best man win. But I have confidence in folks like you.
Okay.
That give regular feedback as to what you need. And it's heard by our members of Congress. And it's heard by our defense establishment. And we know how to stay ahead.
You bet.
Sleep easy.
Okay, you bet. I'm glad that you mentioned what you did because, of course, my work at within the Air Force, even when I went to the Pentagon Joint Chiefs, I did a lot of strategic planning, strategic concerns. But the thing that got me about that and the reason why I brought up the hypersonic missile is because, you know, some genius gets on TV and says, well, they got the hypersonic missile. We don't have a defense against that. And I'm thinking, don't show them our playbook. If we don't have it, don't tell them that. They probably already know it anyway. But I got to thinking, nice going, guy. Yeah, it's almost like a football coach saying, we're going to win this game. I hope they don't throw a Hail Mary because we have no defense against a Hail Mary. They'll be throwing Hail Marys all game long. And be, you know, so I got to thinking, why would they say something like that? You know, come on, man. But again, you said, hey, sleep easy. We got this.
We got this. I agree. At least I agree with you that our guys should have the right to chest pound and in the bombastic conversation we hear from the other side, where the other side has nothing, but we've got something.
Okay.
So I ditto you, okay? That's a good point.
Okay.
Totally agree with you.
You bet. Hey, I'm almost through with your hashtags. I think we already touched the other one. The other one was a foundational technology, but I think that, you know, we kind of got through that one. But the one hashtag that I'm really interested in, especially in terms of, you know, kind of, to me, it's dealing with the elephant in the room. Hashtag national security law, in terms of what's going on with the Ukraine phenomenon. And I say phenomenon because every time you see one of the refugees, God bless them, coming out of there saying, who thought in this day we would be reliving World War II type stuff in the year 2022. Then you get a lot of the analysts you see on CNN or whatever say the same thing. Whoever thought we'd be living through these times or whatnot. So I'm sure that national security law is going to get in terms of, you know, somebody's doing something wrong. And we hear that Biden has actually came out and says, okay, Putin, you're a war criminal. And then that conjures up Nuremberg trials, the hope, which we're all probably not going to happen, you know, because what are they going to do? Send a U.S. Marshal to Moscow and arrest Putin? That's not going to happen. So national security law, what aspect, help me on that one.
Well, first of all, national security law has two very large components, okay?
Okay.
One is the U.S. component.
Okay.
You know, all of this, the our Constitution, obviously. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have, you know, a whole infrastructure of national security law that addresses, you know, when to engage, when not to engage, the whole defense trade, dual use trade, that's all law. The interior of your military operations, of course, that's, you have military justice, but that also has is superimposed with the other constitutional law and everything else that goes with it. So there's our sovereign sphere of law, but then there's another big aspect. International law is guided by treaties. So
okay.
we've basically created this international legal environment post World War II.
Mm-hmm.
We've created it in our image, meaning it respects people's liberties
mm-hmm.
and dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And it also guides the pathway of country to country engagement in a civil discourse, in a humanitarian focused exchange. Okay, so these are all an extension of our values and our principles.
Mm-hmm.
And in that environment, so if you have this monster
mm-hmm.
who is a megalomaniac, invades another country that happens to be not just an independent country, but its people and its president is freedom loving. Okay.
Mm.
I mean, I'm moved to tears listening to President Zelensky and some of the interviews I see of the Ukrainians in the battleground trying to defend
yes.
their homeland. And it makes me very angry.
Mm.
And I do realize that there isn't a popular support for us to directly intervene. I understand that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But we could intervene in so many other ways. And one of the things that I advocated early on, if you go through my postings, is that I was always concerned about a nuclear standoff.
Yes.
Truly, truly, I was terrified, and I
mm-hmm.
said so, and I'm still wary of it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that I'm really concerned about is the problems that this man can cause inside Ukraine. So Ukraine is a country in the 1990s, under the Nunn-Lugar Act, gave up its nuclear missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a lot of money helping Ukraine clean up the fallout from not just Chernobyl, but all of the factory dumping. And Ukraine is the location of the Soviet defense factories. So we spent money, training, a lot of resources to clean up Ukraine and keep Ukraine honest. So now you have the biggest enemy controlling Ukraine of the assets that we worked hard to protect.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a danger zone. The second thing is that we have the International Criminal Court, and I can tell you one of my postings we'll see is
yeah.
They have opened up an investigation on the war crimes taking place in Ukraine as it is. Cluster
yes.
bombs.
Okay? Yes.
We see children blown up to bits. One of the reasons that cluster bomb has been banned for many years
mm-hmm.
is because you cannot trace these people. You cannot do head counts of how many people died. Okay. I mean, it's like, I mean, I can't tell you as a mother how that makes me feel. Okay. So
mm-hmm.
they're actually in the process of preserving evidence
mm-hmm.
such that when hostilities cease, we can bring Putin and whoever his henchmen are to justice.
Mm.
And I hope to God that happens. Okay. I don't know what role we can play. But I can tell you that if we don't play a role, then no one else can. So I really would love to see, these are people that should be brought to justice. If they can't be brought to justice before the international court of whatever they have, they're going. But certainly, I would say bring them to justice in the United States of America,
mm-hmm.
If that's possible. And sure. Legally, how that ties in, I can certainly establish the connection, okay? Mm-hmm. I hope the people watching at the State Department, General Counsel's office, starts, you know, getting their act together.
Okay.
Figure it out. Because if we don't hold these people as an example of the greatest humanitarian disaster
mm-hmm.
of the 21st century, which is right. what we're living in, I think we would have failed as Americans. I really do feel that.
You know, and it's interesting because it's the old iconic expression there from the Jonestown massacre there in
yes.
South America. What was the inscription over the throne? It says, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. There's constantly a comment about what the Russians did in Syria, and they were not slapped on the wrist or anything. So some are saying, is it any surprise that, whew, we got away with that one. Let's try this one again, type
Correct.
Of thing. Yeah. And it's, they're feeling like, you know, they're just, you know, hey, they're bulletproof. Can't be stopped, type of thing. The one saving grace to me, you know, in my Neanderthal logic and knowledge of all this national security stuff, is that there is no statute of limitations on war crimes. I mean,
Agreed.
So unless these guys who like the henchmen planning to spend the rest of their life, you know, in Russia, they're not going to travel anywhere. There'll be people waiting for them at the airport when they land. But that's one saving grace that I would like. And I'm glad, but you mentioned the background that you mentioned, because I think that the question that I had next was that in terms of all that you do and all these things with which you are affiliated and with which you are aligned, we would like to hear your impressions of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I think you've covered that one. I mean, yeah, hey, you nailed that one. Of course, you know, now again.
Also, Major, I wanted to add on that whole sphere of things.
Okay.
We should not forget the fact that another theater is just happening in the Indo-Pacific. What happens in Ukraine doesn't stay in Ukraine.
Yes.
So the Indo-Pacific and Taiwan, and there are two treaty partners there, Japan and Australia, and of course, South Korea.
Yes.
All of these countries are watching here because exactly the same thing is gathering storm, as I call it, in the Indo-Pacific. So what mm-hmm. stays in Ukraine doesn't stay in Ukraine.
The thing that made me nervous also during the Winter Olympics, of all things,
right. when
Vladimir Putin, of course, is not really a sports fan, but he shows up and he talks to President Xi. As he mentions Ukraine, President Xi mentions Taiwan. I'm thinking, uh-oh, there they go. You know, that's kind of like the bitches brew type of thing. They're starting to stir it up now. We're making comparisons here. And the experts are saying there really is no comparison there. But they're talking, you know. And then again, like say, Putin has proven himself to be kind of like, off the reservation, whatever that means. I mean, he's not a logical thinker. Like, you know, whatever he does or says never surprises anybody, because he may come up with anything. You know, some people, it was a characterization of one of my college professors. Some people stop at reason and logic. He stops at nothing. You know,
I think there is evidence that this is a man that has lost it. I mean, truly, there are some serious neuroses here.
Yeah.
That lots and lots of people are saying. I remember the former president of Ukraine was being interviewed, and
yes.
he was on the battlefield, and he said that the Putin he met in the early 2000s, and then later on in 2014, and later on, not that long ago in 2020, mm-hmm. is not the same man. So there is something unraveling.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say what it is, but this is not a person with all his faculties intact.
Mm.
But here's the scary part. He has his finger on the nuclear button.
You took the word right out of my mouth. That's exactly which is scary. And there's no one to check him. I mean, because the people who are the closest to him to support him are the oligarchs. You
Correct.
Know, and there's nobody really going to mess with them, so to speak. So that makes the whole thing really nerve-wracking, you bet. But like I say again, it's just a crazy setting. But I just want to move on real quickly there. Just now, as far as the conflict and all with Ukraine, Ukrainians are holding their own, surprisingly. So much so that Russia did recently what they've done in the past. All of a sudden, their Secretary of Defense, so to speak, their defense guy, chief guy, he shows up sick and no one's seen him around. That's punishment, the way the Russians think. Because yeah, Putin can't be embarrassed by what's going on. So we got to get a scapegoat. Let's get that guy.
I think that guy's in trouble, by the way.
Oh, okay? Yeah.
So he came to fame succeeding in a war that never happened in Syria. So you remember, Americans just decided to pull out. So the Russians had no one to fight. Right? So they will go in and they spread out and it's completely an open terrain. Okay. Mm-hmm. When they had to fight us, our airplanes, as you know, breached their S-400. Their S-400 doesn't work. So they fought no fight. There was not a single, you know, there's no competition. So he claimed to fame during that time. And he's an engineer by profession. He's never served in the military.
Yeah.
And he has planned this whole thing based on equipment placement rather than actually winning a war. The other problem is that he has not worked. I'm guessing that he had very little contact with the people on the ground or with the generals. So generals are dying at a very alarming rate with the Russians because the communication has broken down. And their desertion is very high because I've heard reports that they can't account for all the headcount of their people that went in. They don't know where people are and they can't understand exactly what kind of a, you know, spread they have or who's where. And the other thing is very interesting is a third of the Ukrainian population or more than a third are actually ethnic Russian. And many of them are people who were veterans of the Soviet war in Afghanistan. They have turned against Putin because they know he's bad news for Russia. They have relatives in Russia that they don't know how they're going to get in touch with them. Okay. So this is a civil war that Putin never actually envisioned. And if he didn't win this war in a week, which he didn't, this was my non-military projection when it all started, that if the Russians don't win this in a week, they're never going to win it.
God, you're good. You called it. And that's it too. And another thing that's really surprising, because you get to thinking, you know, you got this madman, you know, Putin running around, you know, something on this God's green earth must scare him. And they say he's actually afraid of the Russian people. He's afraid of them rising up, you know, a la the Bolshevik situation, which of course was completely different, but uprising. And with, like you say, with the defections, the retreating, the Ukrainian soldiers are catching these Soviet soldiers. Russian soldiers who claim they have no idea why they're there. They thought this is a heck of a training exercise. We think we're on a training exercise. Yeah, these people are shooting back with real bullets type of thing. Right. So I think that confusion is what really is scaring Putin. Go ahead.
Just to kind of add to what you said, sir, is that Putin has made Russia into pretty much a welfare state, a petrodollar welfare state. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that the people he has complete loyalty over are rural Russians.
Yes.
Okay. And those people will do anything for him. Then you have the urban Russians. And they are a mixed bag. So really large contingency of the urban Russians have families spread out across Eastern Europe as well as Western Europe, and many also in America. Right? In addition to that, the urban Russian are very much intermixed with families of the oligarch. So they benefit from the pipeline. Okay, and some of them are quite wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So it's a kind of a mixed picture. So if we were to invest in, let's say, an internal Russian rebellion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our assessment would be to assess the size of the population of rural Russia, which is actually a shrinking base.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a lot of old people
mm-hmm.
and some young people, and they're very isolated.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got the urban Russia that truly, truly benefit from the trade as well as cultural connection to the Western European, Eastern EU sphere,
yes,
as well as America.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you were to put pressure, or so if you were to put sort of a firewall, disconnect the rural Russians from the urban Russians, there are many ways to do that.
Wow.
And you focused on the urban Russians to get their sympathy, I would tell you that you already do.
Yeah.
They know very well that the aftermath of this war is not looking good for them.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of the oligarchs, they're like drug lords running for cover.
Mm.
So I don't know, you come from an era that you remember Miami Vice?
Yes, I
and
do.
The yachts and the white Cadillacs, the pink Cadillacs.
Oh, you bet.
And the big South Beach mansions.
Nostalgia. So
this is the picture with the oligarchs in
yeah.
as places as far apart as Singapore to Vienna to New York to London
yeah.
to Berlin. So this is they're spread apart, and so they're running for cover. Their relatives are extremely worried that their bank accounts may be frozen, so they're
yeah.
trying to isolate their cash.
Yeah.
And their subsidiary sort of cousins and everybody is trying to find cover. So they're in the protection mode.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of people, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The Russian diaspora have a huge influence, continue to have a huge influence on Moscow and St. Petersburg.
Okay.
Both financially, because they get expat dollars coming in,
mm-hmm.
as well as in actual livelihood through trade and whatnot. So it's an interesting proposition to truly look at it and say, if we were to have a plan, how do we go about doing it? And I can tell you that there are pathways. There are roadmaps to it.
Okay. Like I said, I know we can't reveal, but there has right. to be. One thing about the urban Russians, I know that's where your intelligentsia, your intellectuals tend to be there.
Right.
And they're easily placed. One of the, I guess, dangers to the whole situation is, of all people, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I had no idea how much popularity he had there. And now they're trying to shut him down. I'm thinking now, yeah, come on, guy. You know, the big Russian bear is going to shut down the little actor. But they said he has a lot of influence and he's getting the word out. Almost like Radio Free Europe. You know, you probably heard about that. I know
right.
I've got you on age, so I remember Radio Free Europe, you know, when he was trying to get the word out. So I think he's kind of a one-man Radio Free Russia, if you will. But that's it. But something I wanted to bring up that's probably just a little personal, because it is with me too. You have a son who, is he military? Is he a midshipman? I was doing quick research.
He is a ensign.
Ensign.
Yes,
okay,
sir.
Just commissioned.
And he's in an ensign in the United States Navy.
Okay.
And a surface warfare officer.
Ah, okay.
And
yeah.
I don't want to say too much. I don't know who's listening out there.
But, how about that?
He is engaged in what I call is the biggest chest pounding that we have as a nation in freedom of seas navigation operation. And I'm very, very proud of him. And I understand and empathize with all the parents.
Yes.
Who make up this wonderful armed services.
Yes.
That we have. And I've always thought of as the armed services as the best of us. Always. I have not served If I were to do it again, maybe I would.
Okay.
But
you make it.
I'm just I have the enormous confidence.
You bet.
And if I and I'm in my travels, you know, sometimes I bump into one or two of your colleagues sitting mm-hmm. next to me, and I just they are a joy and an honor always.
You always, bet. Sir. Well, I respect that you, I'm not gonna say you danced around that one pretty good, because you said surface warfare. My background in aviation was I got 2,400 flying hours in B-52 bombers. So that kind of gives you an idea of, you know, before I went to the Pentagon, what I did, we were part of what's called the Triad, which of course was the strategic yes. bombers, the Navy surface combatants arm, and then the intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Oh, wow.
So
oh,
you
wow.
said what your okay. son was doing. I was kind of said, hold your breath. I get the, but you navigated that water very, very, very carefully. You didn't have to say anything more. I know.
Well, he's on a cruiser, sir. I can tell you that. He's on a cruiser.
Okay.
And as such, you know that the cruisers roll in the nuclear triad. So
yes,
I would leave it at that.
Yes. Yeah, I can make a comment too, but then we'd all be compromised. You know, like get those. I get sent to Fort Leavenworth. You know, not that I know anybody there, but there's a federal prison, so I'm not going to do that. So we're going to steer away. But I see that pride in you. And I remember we were commenting on something else earlier. You mentioned, hey, I'm a mother, and how you feel about things. Hey, I'm a father. My son, he attempted one semester of college. It didn't go well. I knew it wasn't going well. But see, he did JROTC, which of course is the high school component of ROTC. He did very well there. I knew he was going to go active duty. This is right after 9/11. And so I knew, and so it wasn't, I shouldn't say it too loud because my wife's in the other room, but he went to enlist in the active duty military army.
Oh, wow.
I knew
oh,
it. I just felt it because, you know, I did that. Yeah, I did my time in Vietnam, or not, you know, Vietnam era. I was over there. So I kind of got that sense of that's what he did. But I never forget. She, of course, later on was just so proud of him. Like, yeah, she was thumping her chest, like, hey, my son. Four tours in Iraq, the whole bit. So
oh
we know,
goodness.
As parents, we know, and we got that pride. But she, as a mother, I guess she had a little concern, though. But when she realized that he had actually enlisted, as the recruiter who dropped him off at the house was driving off, she was staring daggers at that guy. And I swear, he sped up. So maybe, you know, I better get away from this mama. But our son went in, four tours, did very well. He did 11 years, but he said he kept thinking about his children. So he said, four tours in Iraq. I said, son, you more than paid your dues. So, you know, so just come yes. on, you know, just do what you're going to do. And he's doing very successfully now, though. But yeah, he was in, he was a ground pounder, like over in Iraq. He was kicking down doors and this, that, and the other thing. But he said, hey, it got to a point where think I paid my due. And he did. So, and I saw that pride of you. We talked about the son.
Well,
hey.
Thank you. I thank him for his service. That
you
is
bet.
A fantastic story.
It is. And I thank your son for his service as well, because believe me, being part of that triad thing, I know you don't have to fill in the blank. When you mentioned what he did, I could fill in the blanks, but if we're not going to do
yes,
it over
sir.
This situation, this yes, podcast, we're not going to fill in the blanks, but you bet. But I do appreciate that.
He was in the, just like your son, my son started out in the Sea Cadet.
Okay.
He was in the Sea Cadet for the same thing. He started in high school, ninth grade.
Yeah.
And then he moved up. And he took all those exams and he got his rank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had his field trip to the New Jersey.
Okay.
And he just got a big kick out of it. He spent a week on the New Jersey, in which is parked in New Jersey, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, just like we have the USS Alabama, which is right off the coast of right near Mobile, Alabama. But I think that they did that because they're obviously retired from service. But
yes.
they're there so people can get a touch of history and all. So, but that's good. But you've taken it all. I can see the pride in you. Like, get those. So, and you're going to have me kind of cheer up too, because I still got the pride in my son. And I talked to him about that. He asked me about, well, how is Southeast Asia, Vietnam? I said, you don't know. You don't want to know. Type
oh,
of thing.
Oh, gosh. Yes.
Yeah. But we share stories and all. And like I said, again, it's just a mutual admiration all over. His mom is just so proud of him. Like I said, you used to see her talk about him. You bet. And so I heard you talk about your son. So we're on the same accord with that one. But you know what, things I'm looking at the time. I don't want to just barge into your time. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. And I know my veterans who are listening in, also the law enforcement, we've encouraged that group, as you heard when I initially announced the program. we've got that thing going. So believe me, we're a lot better off after, regrettably, the January 2021 incident. We're a lot better off. I'm with campus security, which is the arm of law enforcement. So I could see that coming from being a veteran to going to security with the interface with all the other security aspects, state troopers, police officers, et cetera, sheriffs. I see that. So you bet. But I've certainly appreciated this conversation with you. You're very forthcoming. You've enlightened me. Now, I know now with CFIUS, did I do that? CFIUS?
CFIUS, correct.
CFIUS. Okay, I got a new acronym. So I'm not going to brag about it because nobody has any idea what I'm talking about. But I certainly enjoy this. So I hope that you have too. And all. So I just want to thank you on behalf of the AFVETS network. I know a lot of people out there have learned a lot more. They probably thought that they knew. And you certainly brought the light there. So Dr. Strickland, all I can say is that, Attorney Strickland, I can just say that thank you so very much for being with us.
You're so welcomed and honored. Thank you, sir.
You bet. Well, you take care. And I maybe you might do this again. You never know.
Absolutely. Call me anytime.
You bet. I sure will. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Major.
Yes, sir.
Are we good?